from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour, he may not be running for president this year, but he certainly has a lot to say about elections. Ralph Nader joins us to talk about his new book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. The former presidential candidate shares his thoughts on civic engagement, reforming the tax code, and how to involve the everyday citizen and the occasional billionaire in rebuilding America. You have questions for Ralph Nader? Join us for Forum next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Veteran consumer advocate and political and governmental reformer Ralph Nader joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. A former candidate for President of the United States, is both a Green Party and an independent candidate. Ralph Nader is the author of the landmark book Unsafe at Any Speed, as well as The 17 Traditions and The Good Fight. And he's been cited by The Atlantic as one of the 100 most influential figures in American history. And he founded over 100 civic organizations, including the famed Nader's Raiders. William Greider in The Nation describes Ralph Nader's newest book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future, as, quote, a subversive primer that should be read in every civics class. Ralph Nader joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
A long time. I hate to say how long it's been, but we go back a long way. And have you exceeded the statute of limitations, or are they still blaming you for Bush?
I have about 100 answers to that. Like, why don't you ask Gore? He'll tell you why he lost.
Well, there's still people angry at you, though, I suppose.
Yeah, it's interesting because they look at third-party candidates, second-class citizens, because if we all have an equal right to run for election, then we're all spoilers of one another, or none of us are spoilers.
Well, you were trying to break the duopoly, right?
Of course. And they agree. I mean, the people who are most upset are the people who agreed with my positions. They call themselves progressives, but it's as if, I was to blame for the theft of votes in Florida. I was to blame that Gore didn't get Tennessee. I was to blame for the Electoral College. You know, Gore won the popular vote. What other country can you come in second like Bush did and become president? We have a political Supreme Court, 5-4. This is not a minor issue. This is something that people have got to ask themselves, do they want a competitive democracy with a large choice of candidates, or do they want to be given an increasingly narrower choice of Republican Democrats who dial for the same commercial dollars?
Well, you're still stirring things up. I noticed in Politico, for example, you said that in some ways President Obama is worse than President Bush. You called him a war criminal, and you said he's maybe better than Romney, but came out swinging again against both parties and said the Republican Party now is worse than it's ever been and the Democrat Party is corrupt.
Well, both parties and both presidents, whether it's Bush or Obama, are outlaw presidencies. I mean, in foreign and military policy, it's clear as can be. They are initiating wars, invasions, drone attacks, sometimes attacking countries like Libya without any congressional authorization, appropriation, declaration of war, or war resolution. He found $1.5 billion somewhere deep in the Pentagon basement, and he attacks this country. So now he topples Gaddafi, and Libya is in chaos, and the fighters went south, and now
an ambassador killed.
An ambassador killed in the fight. They went into Mali. Now Mali is considered by Hillary Clinton as a major haven for terrorists. So you see, boomerang, boomerang, boomerang.
Talking with Ralph Nader. Well, talk about boomerangs. We're going back in some ways in this new book of yours to things that you've stood for low these many years and things that you really wanted to, I suppose, put out there, maybe even for the younger generation, the Occupied movement. You must have had them in mind.
Yes, very much. I mean, the 17 solutions here have a unique characteristic. They are very practical. They're long overdue. Full Medicare for all, living wage, cracking down on corporate crime, taking the bloated military budget down, using the money from corporate welfare terminations, and changing the tax system to pour into public works, you know, building, rebuilding, modernizing America's schools, clinics, sewage systems, water systems, public transit all over the country, creating good jobs. Is that radical? I mean, that would come in 70-80% in the polls. But the interesting thing about these 17 solutions, Michael, is they're not discussed at all in Democratic and Republican campaigns, and not just presidential campaigns, not just presidential debates, but right down to the senatorial and congressional level.
I don't think you're going to hear them tonight with Biden and Ryan either.
No.
Most of these.
It's almost as if they implicitly agree to delete very important considerations and redirections, like the minimum wage.
And many foreign affairs issues as well.
And for sure. I mean, the only dissent is Romney's jumped on Obama for not being aggressive enough, for not, you know, showing our power enough, for not pushing people around in the third world enough. That's all he has left in terms of elbow room. It's not like Obama's been reticent.
Talking with Ralph Nader, and his new book is out. It's called The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. 17 is a number that certainly is often identified with Ralph Nader. His book about his Connecticut boyhood has the number 17 in it as well. So I guess the publisher thought that was a good idea. Numerology.
That's right.
Let's talk about, you've been after the corporate oligarchy for years now, and in the book you're talking about a national charter for corporations, crackdown on corporate crime, and really doing something to diminish corporate welfare, as you call it. The whole system really is built, I mean, even with Citizens United, is built almost antithetical to what you're advocating here. So you've got all these congressional representatives who pretty much are getting money and are dependent in terms of reelection on that money. And it seems to many all these years like, how do we move that? And you're talking about moving it through watchdogs?
Oh, it's so easy to turn it around. I mean, when you say to yourself, where should our country be going? Where should our community be going? How should workers be treated? How should consumers be treated? How should we get clean elections? You don't think you have a majority of people? You may have liberal conservatives on that. And so the key issue is it's like a principle of physics. Where do you have the greatest leverage to turn the government around and put Wall Street in an accountable position and make these corporations our servants, not our masters? Congress. 535 men and women. And they all want your votes. But there's nothing organized out there except a few single issue groups. There's nothing organized for general redirections, as I describe in the book, The 17 Solutions.
You need the energy of bird watchers, you say.
Yeah. I mean, look, there are 15 million bird watchers. Some of them are incredibly intense and dedicated, up in the morning in the marshes, regardless of the weather, with all the equipment, you know, connecting with one another. And they do connect with one another in terms of how many birds they watch. And why can't we have Congress watchers? It's just such a simple idea. There are people who work overtime on hobbies. Complex hobbies, not just stamp collecting, coin collecting, matchbox collecting. There are people who every day do things far more difficult than organizing Congress watchdog groups in every congressional district, like raising children.
Now look at the energy in the Occupy movement. I mean, that could have, had it been mobilized, yeah. if it had the right leadership, if it didn't have the anarchic people joining what they were doing there, but, you know, that it could have been moved in the kind of directions you're talking about, but it never quite congealed.
That's right. Its anarchic, disorganized nature was essential for the encampments. You couldn't have, you know, real organized people and say they're going to take over Zuccotti Park in New York City. But that was the first stage, and it was great. It created a great slogan, the 99%. It unified a lot of people around the country. They had a lot of public opinion polls supporting them. But when the police evicted them from the encampments, they lost their base, so to speak, including their media base. And there was no Act Two. Now, they still go and help prevent foreclosures for families around the country, and they do other things on banks. But they lost a great opportunity. It's not too late to recover, though. I urge them that they should pick up this minimum wage issue because there are 30 million workers between $7.25 and what it should be if it was adjusted for inflation from 1968, which is a little over $10. 30 million workers. Think of that as a goal for the Occupy movement. Think of how their whole efforts would have grown. It could have been a major political movement. They didn't want to go into politics. See, politics is dirty. politicians. They didn't want to deal with them. Yet so much of what the Occupy movement wanted, not all of it, but had to go through government. It had to go. If they wanted to get rid of these criminal wars of aggression, it has to go through government. They could develop their community economies, their credit unions, their farmer markets, their local renewable energy. But a lot of what they wanted had to go through government. So they had to take control more of their members of Congress. And they were. I would talk to many of them. They would just say, we're not organized for that.
But in these 17 solutions, you're not only talking about reforming government and major reforms that you've stood for, Citizen Raiders and Citizen Nader all these years, but you're also challenging parents to do something about, well, of course, this gets to Congress too, but what you call electronic violence and addiction debris, to use your phrase, what pollutes the children's environment. And you're talking about moving toward more emphasis on athletics. And perhaps one of the most radical ideas here, which may not have all that much to do with reforming government in the specific ways that you've outlined in the catalog that you have here, is getting the billionaires. I mean, this is a radical idea in itself. Now, let's talk about these maybe separately. First of all, athletics.
Athletics, we're a spectator society. We sit there eating junk food, drinking junk drinks, and watching these professional athletes on screens. And that's not healthy. There's a huge overweight society. Our children are skyrocketing obesity and overweight, diabetes early in life, high blood pressure coming down the line. So in this chapter, we said, look, let's go back to unorganized sports. Let's go back to participatory sports.
This is Bud Wilkinson, JFK, right?
That goes back to the old days, right? Yeah. I mean, we need more hoops in front of garage doors, something that simple. Sandlot baseball, things that are unorganized, spontaneous, not super competitive. So you have three generations involved. You have grandparents, parents, and they're able-bodied, and their kids.
So it's organized politically and disorganized athletically.
Yeah. Instead, taxpayers are forced to pay for gigantic stadiums and ballparks where these hugely paid players make a lot of money for the hugely overcompensated billionaires who own the teams. And the neighborhood recreational facilities are deteriorating. We need more of them. We need more modern ones. And that's what this last 17 solutions is all about.
And how do you want to bring in these overcompensated billionaires exactly?
Well, I assume there's about 1% of them who are not narcissistic, who are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, have a different perspective on life, looking at their grandchildren and posterity and where their beloved
their
country.
Legacies. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, people forget that there were some rich, proper Bostonians and New Yorkers who funded the abolition movement against slavery. They helped fund Frederick Douglass and other great leaders in that area. Rich women helped fund the women's suffrage, right to vote movement in the 19th century. And in the later years, the Curry family and the Stern family helped fund the early civil rights movement in the 1950s.
Too many ideologues are quick to dismiss
the
privileges as being plutocratic and all that.
Yeah,
and,
well, most of them are. Yeah. Most of them are.
Dismiss all of them. I mean,
the danger of a stereotype is 100%. You never want a stereotype. Even if you have an unfair stereotype, do not stereotype 100%. There's always a 1% or 2%. And justice needs money. A lot of these solutions could be accomplished very rapidly if thousands of organizers were fielded to work every day in congressional districts, mobilizing people with a laser beam focus on their senators and representatives. You'd be surprised how fast the legislature and Congress will turn around.
Talking to Ralph Nader, his new book, The 17 Solutions, and he'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco this evening at 7 o'clock, and you can speak with him. In fact, let me tell you how you can do that. You can join our program, and we welcome your phone calls. Toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is available to you now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls, 866-733-6786, or email us. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. You can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but please feel free, again, to join the program. Number of ways to do that. So we're talking also about polluting the children's environment. And tell us what you envision here.
Well, corporations are raising our children more and more as parents are away, two jobs, commuting. they know how to beam electronically these programs. And what are they selling these kids? They're selling them food that's bad for them, drinks that's bad for them, violent programming, interactive violence. They're dumbing them down. That's why I call these corporations electronic child molesters. They have phrases at their seminars. We've been at their seminars, very high-paid marketing seminars. We've had researchers there. They call this is preparing the children for the corporate parent week. Corporate parent, they say. And
that's not a national holiday, is it?
No. But you see, they know. They have psychoanalyzed these kids. They know more about these kids and their peer groups and all that, and what age, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, than their parents do. And their parents have to fight this constantly. Imagine, millions of parents have to fight the dominant commercial culture. I mean, even primitive societies don't have to fight the dominant culture.
So if they get together and they consolidate and they have solidarity, where do they go with this? I mean, you run into First Amendment problems because of all the advertising that's done and all the commercial manipulation.
Yeah, first you have a little bit of equal time. I mean, the public owns the public airways. They ought to have their own networks and programs a few hours a week. And they can criticize and shame these people and shame them by name, like the head of a food cereal company that's selling cereal that's 50% embedded sugar. And you say, would you give this to your child, Mr. So-and-so? That's one. The second is avoidance. There are all kinds of activities in every community begging for participation and involvement. Cultural activities, arts, crafts for children, historical societies, playgrounds, and the sidewalks are empty. You got these kids, they're spending half their life in virtual reality, looking at screens, sending text messages. And so what we're doing to our kids are enveloping in this corporate cocoon of marketing and exploitation. And none of the parents, the surveys of the parents say they're at wit's end. They've lost control of their kids to these gadgets, these corporate marketing.
So is the problem the corporations as much as the technology?
It's all. I mean, you got to hit it on all fronts. But there's a lot of activities, and we cite some of these. Look at Friday. I mean, the Washington Post, they have a weekend section. You can't believe how many wholesome activities there are. I mean, there are almost more activities than our population, for heaven's sake. And people have got to take their kids there. They've got to get them out of virtual reality into reality. This gadgetry is a form of electronic addiction, the depths of which we haven't begun to probe in terms of their damage on children. They don't even talk to their siblings. You've got kids that wake up in the morning in their bedroom and they text message their parents in the kitchen telling them they don't want oatmeal.
We're talking again with Ralph Nader, and his new book is 17 Solutions. One of your solutions, again, has to do with hitting the military bloated budget. We just heard from candidate Romney that he wants to increase it, and certainly almost any presidential candidate has to take that position. If not increasing it, keep things stable and status quo.
Well, let's say we don't have any major enemy left in the world unless we're worried about Moldova or Inner Mongolia. There's no more Soviet Union. So why do we have the biggest military budget, bigger than during the Cold War, in American history? It's now $800 billion direct, and then there's all the indirect interest payments, veterans support, and so forth, because of what Eisenhower warned us about. There's a military-industrial complex, and finding new enemies and the war on terrorism is a hugely profitable operation for thousands of companies.
This is not to say the enemies aren't out there.
Yeah, there's some criminal gangs out there, but do you need another 14 aircraft carriers? What are aircraft carriers going to do for criminal gangs? Nuclear submarines, F-22s that are still in the pipeline that were designed for the Soviet Union, and they're still costing like $200 million a plane, and you could put the plane on a high school platform in a high school auditorium. That's how much the electronics cost. I talked to people in the office of Secretary of Defense called OSD years ago. This should never have been a F-22. You're just taking off from Eisenhower's great speech, the Cross of Iron speech in April 1953, when he said, you know, we could destroy the Soviet Union and they can destroy us. Is this a way to live? And then the only president in history, he listed the price of bombers and tanks and ships and said, look how many schools and clinics and public transit this would build. No president has done it. They've been intimidated by what Eisenhower warned us about, which is the military-industrial complex. Now, I always go back to the former head of the Air Force, General McPeak. a few years ago. He said if the U.S. government cannot defend America on $300 billion a year, we better get a new set of generals. It's $800 billion and growing. $2 billion a week on Afghanistan alone. We're blowing apart Afghanistan, and the Taliban are more powerful than ever. We have Al-Qaeda now in 22 countries when it was only in Afghanistan.
Gee, I thought the FBI said that they've almost disappeared.
From Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So they've gone to Pakistan. They've gone to Libya. They've gone to North Africa, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq. They're destroying Iraqis right and left with these bombs in Iraq. So what happens is just what a national security expert once said on TV. He said, we shouldn't have an anti-terror policy that creates more terror.
Talking with Ralph Nader. And as ever, Ralph Nader, how do you keep this passion alive in you all these years?
I had a good choice of parents. And I, as a child, you know, Michael, I couldn't stand bullies. I actually got red and flushed in the face when a fourth grader would beat up a second grader. So, you know, you grow up that way. And I wanted to be a lawyer. And to me, a lawyer meant fighting for justice. It didn't mean working in the Wall Street canyons for corporate behemoths like Goldman Sachs or Citigroup.
They're not doing as well these days, are they? Those big pensions have almost become a thing of the past, though we need obviously more regulation from your perspective, I'm sure. Big regulations.
But the average pay on Wall Street is near a record high. It's $345,000 a year. That's averaging the top and the lower ones. And they know how to feather their nest. They're brilliant at it. The top executives. I mean, look at the head of Walmart. Now, there's a little activity with workers around the country starting in Walmart, try to get a decent standards and wages, maybe even a union. The head of Walmart makes $11,000 an hour, every hour. So he goes to work on January 2, and before he has his three martini lunch, he's made more than any one of a million Walmart workers make in the entire year. Now, he didn't earn that. He had a rubber stamp board of directors that he and his forebears selected to rubber stamp these outrageous compensation.
Now, these high CEO salaries seem to be almost unassailable. They just continue to increase.
That's because one of the solutions in this book is to strengthen the authority of investors, which means not only individual investors, but pension funds and mutual funds. Now you can own corporations and control nothing, because the corporate bosses have split ownership from control. They control. They're the hired hands at the top. But the shareholders are basically told, you don't like the way we operate? Sell the stock. And in other words, don't exercise your powers of ownership and get rid of the rascals at the top. It's a system that the Kremlin would have been envious of in terms of a top-down authoritarian regime.
We almost have our own Politburo, don't we?
But it's much better compensated.
Well, it's an economic compensated, yeah, far beyond what... Well, the Soviets didn't do bad. You know, they had those Dakas in Yalta, and they were living pretty high off the hog.
And they had these special stores.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that it was quite the way Trotsky planned it to be. We're talking to Ralph Nader. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club 7 p.m. in San Francisco this evening, and you can speak with him. In fact, when we return, we'll go to your calls and emails. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. And again, you can post any questions or comments on our website at kqed.org/forum. Just go ahead and click on this segment or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. And our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Ralph Nader. His newest book is The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future, and he'll be at the Commonwealth of California this evening, 7 p.m. Let's go to your calls, and we begin, Neil, with you. Good morning.
Yes, Mr. Nader, I'd like to know what you would consider a just use of force in foreign policy. Are you opposed to any use of force? We were hardly the only country to intervene or to seek an intervention in Libya, and I don't see how it did the Libyans that much harm to get rid of Gaddafi. How would you define a just use of force in foreign policy?
Defense, an attack on our country or an imminent attack on our country. That's the only legitimate international law support for going to war.
So people are being slaughtered in Bosnia, stay out of it?
That should be done by a professional United Nations force. It should not be done unilaterally. We should have, many, many years ago, gotten together with other countries so a professional United Nations force could go in and stop these massacres, and it would be under full international law. What do we get getting rid of Gaddafi? I mean, Gaddafi was terrible, but we were rapprochement with him. He was, you know, eliminated his weapons and was trying to be part of the community of nations. But he's still a brutal dictator.
And so is Assad in Syria, and many are saying we need to go in there, or we need to get an international force to go in there. But every time it goes in front of the United Nations, China and Russia blocks it.
Right. It's just going to be worse. The sectarian bloodshed will be enormous. The Christians are terrified. The Assad regime supported, even though he was a dictator, they supported and protected the minorities. And now if you blow a country like that apart, just like we blew Iraq apart, there'll be horrendous bloodshed. It'll spill over into Jordan. It'll spill over into Lebanon. What do we have to do, police the entire Middle East? We don't seem to want to work through the United Nations historically so we can get these problems addressed in full accord, and we become an empire.
What about working through NATO?
NATO has no business outside of Europe. But now it's in Afghanistan. NATO is just a cover for us. They say NATO soldiers, NATO. We're 90% of NATO. Canada's pulling out, and other countries are pulling out of Afghanistan. It's a total quagmire. There are more killings now going on, more sectarian death and injury. See, we don't understand the history or anthropology of these countries at all. So it's what the CIA call blowback. They created that word. That's when you go into a foreign country and it blows back on you and things are even worse and out of control. So then you got to put more troops and more drones as it spreads all over the world. And every empire in the history of the world has devoured its own people. Every empire, when it's fallen, has devoured itself. And we have so impoverished our country with the diversion of money for the empire that we've got half of the people in this country who are really poor. Half of the people in this country. We're an advanced third world country. We've got modern computers, modern military, science, but the livelihood of more and more people is disgracefully shameful. And that's what the 99% people were talking about.
Caller, Mark, you're on.
Hi. First, I wanted to thank you both for all your years of service, and historical perspective has never been so refreshing as this morning. I wanted to ask Mr. Nader about what he thinks of Project VoteSmart, which is doing one of the things he's said. It's tracking, I think, the top couple dozen issues. It's tracking politicians' voting records and then trying to disseminate that.
It's a very good program. It really gets down to the nitty-gritty of, do you really want to know what your member of Congress has been doing? Your member of Congress has been given your power. Is your member of Congress using your power in Congress against you on behalf of the Wall Street paymasters, or are they using it on your behalf? So this is very good. But for it to work, people have to do more homework. They have to understand what's going on in Congress. I mean, Congress spends 22% of their income. If their neighbor spent 22% of their income, they take an interest in their neighbor. You know the question I ask, Michael, people? It's a little facetious. I say, you know, Congress affects you in every way, good or bad. It can send you off, children off to war. It can allow companies to rip you off. It can raise your taxes. It can lower your taxes. It spends 22% of your income. I said, do you spend more time looking at the mirror over a period of a year, or do you spend more time looking at your Congress?
Well, you also say that when it comes to taxes in Congress, we should tax on the things we like and not tax on the things we don't like.
Yeah, that
seems very simple equation.
Equation, liberals and conservatives, I think, would like that. You tax things you like the least or dislike the most. So what is it as a society? Well, we don't like wild speculation that can crash an economy like Wall Street. So you should tax Wall Street speculation, derivatives. $600-700 trillion last year in derivative trading, and they don't pay
a
sales tax. They don't pay a sales tax.
Nothing.
I mean, here in California, what do you pay, 7-8% sales tax on necessities of life? Today, someone can buy $100 million worth of General Motors derivatives and pay no sales tax. You could raise $300 billion on just a 0.5%. Now, other countries are thinking about this. We actually had a transaction tax in 1905.
Well, we're going to talk about a proposition in the next hour, in fact, that's on the California ballot, one of the referendum measures that will change the tax structure for out-of-state corporations, which now pretty yes. much are tax-free, but more of that in the next hour. Getting a lot of emails and web comments and everything on, well, you might imagine, on politics and on your role in previous elections. Here's Michael in Oakland who writes, "As someone who is still mad at Ralph Nader for the 2000 election, I'll tell you why. One of the ways politics works is through compromise, deal-making, tit-for-tat, call it what you will. It takes more than having better ideas to get things done. During that election, I sent an email to the Nader for President campaign suggesting that Ralph Nader back Al Gore in exchange for becoming Secretary of the Interior. 6 months after the election, I got a response that essentially said, 'Thanks for your interest in Mr. Nader's bid for president. We're broke. Please send money.' I think that about says it all. If you want to make a difference, build a competent organization that can actually do something. Mr. Nader was a hero when he took on GM, but he was totally out of touch and ineffectual when he ran for president."
Tell that to the voters. We had majoritarian positions. You can look. We kept my website for 2008 open. Take a look at them. It's votenader.org, and you'll see 18 major redirections in our country. Poll them. Why don't the voters choose people who they believe in? Because they're in a two-party trap. They're told from when they're kids, there's only one that's going to win, Republican, Democrat, the Electoral College, winner take all, no proportional representation, gerrymandered districts. You know, any progressive who agrees with the positions of the Green Party or my independent run should ask themselves why they don't vote for politicians they believe in. Why do they vote for the least worst? Once they vote for the least worst, they have no bargaining power.
So here's Daniel on Facebook who says, "What does Mr. Nader think of rank voting? I see this is the only real way to effect change and wrangle power away from the two parties."
Well, that's called instant runoff voting, and that will get rid of the so-called spoiler issue, because when you vote, you vote, let's say, for Jill Stein on the Green Party, and your second...
We had a mayor elected in Oakland because of rank voting, as you mentioned, yeah. Gene Kwan.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the second vote would be, say, the Democrat, and the third vote someone else, and it automatically, instant runoff. So no one's going to win unless they get a majority. You know, that's a good way to do it.
We'll go to more of your calls, and we'll bring Greg on. Greg, you're on.
Hi. Mr. Nader, thank you for coming on the show. Actually, you just answered my question. I was a little disillusioned after voting for Obama in 2008, especially as after he reversed his stance on drilling for oil in the Gulf of Mexico. And well, I was going to ask, which independent candidates do you support right now? And what else can we do to get more people in the Green Party and other parties to get out and vote, not just for one of the major parties?
Well, you basically ask them, what do they want their political representatives to do in this country? And start talking issues, redirections, solutions, and say, well, you know, there's one party... the Green Party has a good agenda here in California, and Rocky Anderson is a write-in vote, two-time elected mayor of Salt Lake City. He worked with Romney on the Olympics. Says he's a different Romney, by the way.
I think most people would agree with you that there's a desire for many of the changes that you outline here, not only because the polls show that, but President Obama's election had a lot to do with change and the whole motto that he, the anthem really of his campaign being change that you can believe in and all that. And there are many disillusioned people. But the argument would always come back to you, and I'm sure it does, that the desire may be there. Most Americans believe we're on the wrong track as far as the trajectory of this country.
Yeah.
But where's the political will? And where does that come from?
Well, whenever you have candidates who get elected who don't arise from mass movements, they're not going to know where they came from. They're going to start spending every day with commercial interests and lobbyists in Washington and Sacramento, campaign money, whining, dining, friendship, golf outings, and they lose touch with the people because they didn't come from the people. That's why the most fundamental political reform movement in America, the populist progressive movement in the late 1880s, swept across the country, elected senators, governors, almost a president, because they came from the people. You see?
So you're talking about populism.
Yeah. So instead of just talking about these candidates and how do they look and what do they say and what do they promise, why don't we look at ourselves and say, why aren't we organizing grassroots political movements, which we certainly can. Nobody can stop us from marching and demonstrating and putting more people on the ballot. Nobody can stop us from teaching our kids civic skills, even if they won't do it in the schools. We can do it after school. Nobody can stop us from having mass training sessions so we can learn civic skills ourselves as adults. And then you'll see a completely different country. It's the easiest thing to turn the country around. I've got another 1%, Michael. 1% was Wall Street and the super rich. The other 1% are the active, engaged citizens connecting one another in every congressional district to turn the Congress and therefore the government around and reorder our priorities and our budgets and rebuild our country, okay? That's all it takes. As Abraham Lincoln said, with public sentiment, you can achieve anything.
Here's the kind of rejoinders to that. I'm looking at Angus, who writes on our website. Does Ralph Nader truly believe that the existing corporate-occupied federal government can be reformed? It seems to me that the general public is impervious to rational arguments offered by third parties and will always support one of the two corporatist parties, giving those parties a mandate for even worse behavior each time until we ultimately have no democracy.
Well, that's a very...
That's grim. That's bleak.
Yeah, that's a very bleak view. Two answers to that. One is... I once said, I don't care who's in Congress as long as they can read and write if the people back home are organized. Because I've seen corporate senators in the early 60s completely turn around because of the rumble and the organization from the people in the 60s. Senator Magnuson, for example, he used to be in the pocket of business interests as the powerful chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee. He became the greatest consumer legislative champion in American history in the Congress because he heard the rumble from the people. And Nixon signed all kinds of laws he hated. He signed the Environmental Protection Act, the Occupational Safety Act, the Products Safety Commission. He wanted a minimum incomes plan to abolish poverty, right? He had a drug policy that emphasized rehabilitation, not incarceration. Why? He didn't believe in these. Because he heard the rumble from the people coming out of the 60s. Well, is it that much to produce a rumble from the people?
What about the Tea Party rumble, then? How does that fit?
Yeah, that just shows you. The Tea Party was never more than 300,000-400,000 people around the country, according to the Washington Post. But they were the only rumble in town. Now, luckily, they had Fox News as their trumpet. And now you got these Republicans in Congress who never heard of the Tea Party putting the Tea Party label on them, saying, look, it's a Tea Party. We're Tea Partiers. And these were mostly small business bourgeois people. And it's because they showed up in town meetings. I mean, you got to show up in town meetings. You shake the Congress. They're still afraid of the people, but not when the people are asleep, not when they make excuses for themselves about how they can't change anything. Oh, me, oh, my. That's the key. If you grow up powerless, you will be powerless.
Our guest is Ralph Nader. His new book is The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. And we go to Santa Clara and welcome Dan. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First, you know, Mr. Nader, love all of your work. Domestic stuff you've done, just can't get enough. I think you're the greatest considerate advocate we've ever had. Cannot agree with you more on the importance of the people being active in our politics. That said, I think we part ways when it comes to foreign policy. Specifically, I do not think that Gore would have invaded Iraq. I'd like to know your opinions on that. And also, bearing in mind, your election in Florida is one reason why we had Bush instead of Gore. I'll take my answer offline, please.
All right.
See, he's a perfect example of thousands of people with that attitude, and he's probably call himself a liberal progressive. First of all, 250,000 Democrats in Florida voted for Bush. I got 97,000 votes. Why don't you blame the Democrats? Why don't you blame the Electoral College? Gore won the popular election. I've talked to Gore about this. He doesn't blame the Green Party. He blames himself, for one. You know, he couldn't get his home state of Tennessee. If everything happened as it happened, including Florida, if he got Tennessee, he'd have been president. If
he also could have brought Clinton, and he didn't.
Yeah, he didn't invite Clinton. So, you know, I tell all these people, look, Bush got more votes from Gore than I did. I only have one vote. Huh? So you don't want to give voters a choice? You basically want to say to voters, shut up, you're not going to have another candidate you believe in. You got to either choose between Bush and Gore. I mean, it's so anti-democratic, but we grow up with that two-party duopoly embedded in our mind. Even Scholastic magazine, when they deal with the kids in the middle school and they want to have these mock votes, you know, during the presidential year, they have Democrat, Republican, and then a blank. So no one else. So
why
didn't
you run
again
this time then? You decided to sit this one out because...
Let someone else, you know, they're good Green Party and other candidates. I've done it several times, and I've documented it through litigation. We won a lot of cases. I've documented duopoly, the exclusion from the debates. Just look at opendebates.org, and you'll see how they control and access to tens of millions of voters through these presidential debates, which is a private corporation that the two parties created in 1987 to get rid of the League of Women Voters' supervision of presidential debates and decide exactly who gets on, who doesn't get on, what reporters ask the question, what the formats are, and limiting the debates to three. We should have 25 debates demanded by people all over the country.
You Sam saw how straitjacketed poor Jim Lehrer was the other day.
Oh, yeah. He tells me, you know, people criticize me, he says, but I have to follow these crazy rules. Well, my answer is, well, Jim, it's about time for you not to follow those rules and just not to get into that kind of rut.
So Eamon on our website writes, sports stadiums create jobs, generate growth, and if positioned properly, like AT&T Park, they can contribute to urban regeneration. Surely there is value in this. In addition, professional athletes, when they behave appropriately, can act as role models and inspire the next generation to participate in healthy sports. The British embraced the doctrine to great effect in their recent hosting of the Olympics. Surely it's okay to have public investment in elite sports if there's a benefit to the wider society?
Boy, that sounds like some PR firm for big-time sports. First of all, tons of economic studies show that tax-funded stadiums are very poor job producers compared to what you could use the money for in the city for economic development and jobs. Take a professional football stadium, right? Take the Oakland Raiders, right? How many days are they working? How many days... maybe 8-9 games, and they have low wage workers, you know, selling Frankfurters. I mean, give me a break. There are almost a consensus among economists. This is not a very good public investment for jobs. Put that money into public transit, repair the schools, improve the sewage and drinking water systems, get the lead out of the drinking water. This is create jobs, and, you know, get people to do solar energy. This is crazy. This is the Roman circus with one exception. They let them in free in Rome.
I think you could say there's less bread.
They didn't have to pay through the nose to watch players play in tax-funded stadiums. Why shouldn't these stadiums be called taxpayer stadiums? Instead, they sell the naming rights to corporations, some of whom go bankrupt.
I got to mention, by the way, I've said a few times that you'll be at the Commonwealth Club. It's not the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. It's the Commonwealth Club in Palo Alto this evening, where you can see and meet Ralph Nader. And Christine on our website says, third-party votes stand on their own, just like whoever your vote goes to stands on its own merits. George W. Bush was elected because his opponents failed, not because a third-party candidate provided a much-needed alternative. I'm sick of hearing his childish claim. Your duty is to vote for whomever best represents your interests, not whomever you think is going to defeat whoever you wish to vote against. This strategy of negative discourse in American elections is precisely what has led to the partisan gridlock we see today. I may write in Mr. Nader in this election, even if he isn't running, and it will not be a vote wasted. The American people get what they deserve by voting strategically instead of authentically. Thank you for your courage and convictions, Mr. Nader.
Well said. And apropos the former caller, I'd like to ask the former caller with a historical footnote, isn't he glad that some voters spun away in the 19th century from the Whigs and the Democrats and voted for the Liberty Party in 1840 against slavery? Or other voters spun away from the two dominant parties and voted for the women's right to vote parties? Or the labor parties? Or the farmer parties? Most of them say, yeah, but not now. Oh, now it's always different.
But American history also teaches that those third parties always get co-opted by the two big parties. That's been the linear fashion.
But they made their initial...
they made impact. Yeah,
that's right.
Absolutely.
And they never won a national election. But look at they pioneered new agendas that one or two of the major parties finally adopted, and we take these changes for granted. But, you know, it's just, we just need more civic education. We've got to learn more, stop making excuses for ourselves, look at civic skills the way we look at computer skills. You know, how do we know how to operate a computer? We develop a skill. How do we know how to fix a car? We develop a skill, improve our porch. We learn carpentry. as citizens. We've got to learn how to become skilled citizens, how to use the Free Information Act, how to study all these wonderful initiatives that are on your ballot. I mean, I come from Connecticut. We don't have statewide initiatives. You've got Prop 30 that restores some of the taxes to the super wealthy, which is essential. Jerry Brown is supporting that. You have Prop 37, which is could sweep the country if it wins, requiring genetically engineered foods sourced in Monsanto to be labeled in the supermarket. 90% of the people want that.
Listener asks, Mr. Nader, you're big on workers' rights. In your opinion, how do we get the right balance between workers' rights and corporate power so that there isn't abuse by either side?
We're a long way away from that. The labor movement in the private corporate sector has never been weaker. We're down to 9% of the workers in the corporate sector unionized. So let's first give people easier ways like they have in Canada and Western Europe to form unions. We obstruct them in so many ways, including the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. There comes a time when unions can be abusive. This has happened in the longshoreman area on the East Coast, for example, some of the building construction trades, and the law's got to be applied there. One problem is that it's often too top-down, and you don't have rank-and-file democracy. So the bosses at the top of the union, just like at the top of corporations, have learned to enrich themselves, have special pensions, etc. There are some very good unions, and one of my favorite is the California Nurses Association, which is spreading all over the country to organize nurses because they also focus on patient well-being and they get good laws through for patient well-being.
Go to another call. Tim, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yeah, hey. Hi, Ralph Nader.
Hi.
What a pleasure and honor. Firstly, I want to say thank you for being you and what you do for this country as a great patriot, a great intellect and all that. And the other on the other side, I don't know if I'll ever be able to forgive you for the 150,000 some odd Iraqis that were killed, and the environment and the gutting of our country and the economy for letting Bush get in, because I really hold you responsible for that. Gore would have been 1,000 times better than Bush, as much as I hate the two-party system. It was high stakes. You should have known that. You should have bowed out gracefully for what was coming, a tremendous storm that we will be recovering from for years. And that's pretty much what I have to say.
Gee, you didn't blame me for Afghanistan. And, gee, I mean, why did you stop there? How about sunspots on the moon? You see, this is an extremely crippling attitude by people. You are basically saying to the American voter that they should not have the right to vote for candidates of their choice. That they should shut up and get in line and vote for one of two corporate parties because one may not be as bad as the other, but both of them flunk. Every 4 years, with that attitude, both parties get worse, both parties get arrogant, both parties dial for the same Wall Street dollars, both parties turn the government against the people. You should know, by the way, that Clinton and Gore got a resolution passed in Congress in 1998 urging the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, and that Bush used that with his lies, along with Cheney's falsehoods, to invade a country that did not threaten us. Notice this. The Democrats in Congress, apart from the 2000 election, could have stopped the war. They could have filibustered it. They could have stopped the war. They could have stopped Chief Justice Roberts' nomination. They could have stopped Alito's nomination. Why are you exonerating these people? You need to clear your head.
I'm not. I hold you responsible for that act, though.
See, that's the sign of a political bigot, because I am lawfully a presidential candidate in that year. I want to give people more choice. The Constitution allows that. And you're saying that the voters should not have a choice to vote for me or anyone else other than Gore and Bush. Well, let me tell you, the two parties don't own the votes in America. They think they do, but I think they have to earn them. And I believe in a competitive democracy. And I can make these arguments and many more until the end of the day, and it will not change your mind because you are a political bigot. Emphasis, political.
Still visceral in you, Ralph. Still got the fire. Brandon is our next caller. Good morning.
Hey, you guys. So, Mr. Nader, I don't blame you for any of what happened. And frankly, everybody, we need to recognize that's water under the bridge and move on. But I really do think my point in calling is regarding the debt. And, Mr. Nader, I just want to run a few numbers by you. I really think that there's going to be a major reset. I think we're in a treasury bubble. I think the debt is going to crush us in a very sudden manner that's going to cause a major reset. I know a lot of people in finance, and they basically tell me, if you throw into Google, for example, U.S. money supply, and you'll be taken to the Federal Reserve's own website, the H6 schedule, you'll see a little paragraph describing what M1 is. M2 currently is a little over $10 trillion. With the QE3 that was just announced, that's printing $40 billion a month. That's $100 billion every 10 weeks, which means our money supply is being printed at a rate of 1% every 10 weeks. Now, most Americans don't give a crap about politics and stuff because they're too busy trying to either get their next bonus or just survive.
Brandon, we're short on time here. I want to get Ralph Nader's response to what you're saying because we're also coming up on a fiscal cliff here, and I'd like to hear about the money supply and your thoughts on that.
Well, the big risk, of course, is if the Federal Reserve performs in a way where inflation comes with a vengeance. And that's a very ravaging devastation on families.
Well, Bernanke and Greenspan before him really tried to keep very tight reins on inflation.
Yeah, yeah. And as the caller says, though, they're printing so much money.
They are.
That it's you know, it is reaching risky levels. The second, of course, is the family debts. The reason why you can say, for example, that Bill Gates in 2000 had more financial wealth than the bottom 120 million Americans is not just that he was very rich. It was that most families are broke at that level. Their assets are less than their liabilities, and they're in debt to their neck. And that's a very dangerous thing, too, for people's livelihoods. But still, isn't it interesting? And none of this is spilling into a political mobilization. That's the big question in this country. Why aren't people demanding a different political system, a cleaner election system, and more say? Because if they don't have more say, the people are going to pay, and that's what they've been doing.
Well, it's all outlined in Ralph Nader's new book. It's much of what he has stood for and what he continues to stand for and passionately fight for, the 17 solutions, bold ideas for our, notice the R, American future. Ralph, always good to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Also, thanks to our interns, Bradley Davis, Riva Gold, Nora McCartan, and Gina Shalaba. We have another hour of Forum coming your way. Stay tuned for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.